along with being the full moon day, then as most people are aware, this is also the final day of the rains retreat, the Vasa period. So this is part of the Buddhist calendar in the southern Buddhist world. This year, going from the full moon, the beginning of August, until now, this full moon at the end of October, this three-month period where we are expected to reside in one place and to be, say, stable and traveling as little as possible, and using this period of time as an opportunity to focus upon retreat practice and for deepening the attention to the aspects of monastic training, and to, particularly to studying Vinaya discipline. The Vasa comes to a close officially at dawn tomorrow. So in the Buddhist calendar, the Buddhist way of reckoning time, a day goes from dawn to dawn. That's the easiest thing to measure, when the dark turns into light, so that we're now in the last day of the rains retreat. And we have these various ceremonies that wind up the period of time in a formal and ritualized way. So this morning, the nuns' community, the monks' community, carried out the Pavarana ceremony, and Pavarana means invitation. And the Buddha allowed on this one occasion during the year, rather than each fortnight, when we do the recitation of our whole monastic rule. So every new moon, every full moon, we gather together and we listen to the entirety of the precepts being recited to remind us of the glue that holds us all together, and to refresh our attention and our respect for the Vinaya, which is the lifeblood, if you like, of the monastic community. And this whole spiritual tradition is held together in many respects by that common code of understanding, common code of practice. So every fortnight through the year, then we recite the monastic rule, and this forms the sort of rhythm of our monastic calendar, if you like. That is that's the defining beat of our monastic communal life, is that recitation of the rule every 2 weeks, every new moon, every full moon. But the Buddha made an exception on one occasion during the year, and that's today, that you didn't have to recite the whole of the rule. And rather than because the rules, it's not just like the you might think reciting the eight precepts is complicated enough, but we have on the monk's side, we have 227 rules. It takes about 45 minutes to recite. It's about 13,000 words, and you have to get it all right. And the nuns' rules, I believe it's about 150 training precepts that they recite, and go through each of their training rules too, one by one. So that's quite an effort. It takes quite a bit of time. So the Buddha relaxed the stipulation to recite the whole rule on this one day of the year. But because it's the time of the year when there's the strongest sense of community, everyone has been living together for the period of 3 months. And in Asia, this is the monsoon season, so that have that as the defining feature of this time and why you wouldn't be traveling. So the Buddha established this three-month period as a specific time of retreat, of training, and of living together. And as one knows, as everybody is probably aware, that when we live together with other people for a considerable period of time, there's likely to be an experience of friction. We don't always agree with each other. My preference is not the same as your preference, and your speed of doing things is different from mine. I might like to be faster, or I might like to be slower, or I prefer salty while you prefer sweet. So the natural experience of human community life is going to involve friction. That's part of the nature of our lives, our way of being. That's just the way life works. There's abrasion, friction in the system. That's normal and to be expected. So the Buddha, being extremely pragmatic, a practical person, he established this procedure of pavarana, making invitation. So at the period, at the end of this period of time where we've all been living together, and Amravati has a resident community of about 45 or 50 people, monastics and lay residents all here together. And so the pavarana is the invitation, and the wording of it is done in a formalized way in Pali, but the wording of it and the spirit of it is not just the recitation of a foreign language, a formula in a foreign language, but rather it's a genuine request. And what is made in the request at the invitation of the pavarana is, for whatever I might have done in terms of my action and speech, I invite the Sangha and the community to let me know, to give me some feedback if I have done anything that has been painful or offensive or inappropriate, and I would like to hear about this, and I give my invitation. So it's a formal way of saying, please let me know if I've been upsetting you, or I've done something that you feel is inappropriate or is hurtful, please let me know. And as I was saying, I was talking with the monks and nuns this morning, there's this wonderful exchange where the Buddha is talking about this process of receiving feedback. And I can't remember exactly where it is in the scriptures, but maybe if people, if anybody is familiar with it, they can let me know. But it's certainly there. And in this description, this simile that the Buddha gives, and he was a brilliant crafter of these kind of memorable images. He said, if you had a choice between being offered a massive pile of gold and jewels that was extraordinarily valuable, so like if you were offered millions and millions of pounds on the one hand, and on the other hand, you were offered the opportunity of receiving some criticism from your friends. He said, if you are desirous of training, if you wish to train yourself, if you're really, say, inclined towards liberation and awakening, you will reject the offer of the pile of gold and jewels, and you'll eagerly invite the criticism that you will dismiss the offer of all the gold and jewels, but you would be enthusiastic. You would immediately move towards requesting the criticism, that the feedback, that your heart would leap towards that. But this is a wonderful image, isn't it? Because who wants to be criticized? Who wants to be told, I don't like what you say, I don't like the way you walk, you don't bow properly, you make funny noises when you eat. Do you realize how much of a racket you make? I'm in the next room, don't you realize you share this building with other people? Yeah. Or, you know, obviously, we put things in a slightly less blunt or aggressive way, but those kind of things in community life that we can upset or irritate each other with, who wants to hear that? You know, our instinct, our ordinary human habit is to avoid being criticized. We don't like to be blamed or to be thought badly of. And so we come from our habitual conditioned self-centered reactions, then we shy away from that kind of criticism, negativity. Don't want to hear it. You know, can't hear. But this wonderful image of the Buddha that the Buddha offers us of the heart leaping towards that. Oh, please, please, please! How kind of you. Rather than a pile of gold and jewels that would be immensely valuable and can make you rich for the rest of your life. So the principle of the Pavarana is that invitation. And then this evening, some of you might have been familiar with this little ceremony that we had after the eight precepts. Some of you will not be familiar with that, but this is what's called asking for forgiveness. So along with the invitation to receive feedback, saying, please let me know, I'm open to receiving feedback. The asking for forgiveness is, in a way, it's a partner to that. And again, it's appropriate particularly to the ending of a time when you've lived together close to other people. And on the same, addressing the same understanding that we are very likely to have caused offense or upset or difficulty in others, even if we're completely unaware of that, or there's no intention whatsoever, we can still cause those negative or painful effects upon other people. We can have a caustic or irritating impact upon the people that we live with. So this little ceremony that was carried out just now. This is saying, whatever I have done by body, speech, or mind, through either of any of the three doors, through body, speech, or mind, dvarata yena, through the dvara, the doors of the body, the speech, or the mind, that has been offensive or painful to you, then please, I ask for your forgiveness. And then they all say that together, and then my response is, I forgive you, and please forgive me also for any wrongdoing of my own. And so this is a formulaic exchange. It's a ritual. There's a standard pattern that is followed. And so it can just be an empty recitation. You know, you do it because everybody else is doing it, and that's what you do because that's what you're supposed to do. Where you can blindly and just cluelessly repeat a ceremony, act out a ceremony, or repeat a formula. But for these customs, these ceremonies to be effective, then it's important to consider them and to breathe life into them. We carry these out not just because it's a custom, but because they have considerable psychological value. They have considerable spiritual value in terms of helping us to establish the most skillful attitudes, so that this asking for forgiveness is recognizing that we get things wrong, we upset others, and it's a humility, as a beautiful humility there, and again, it's encouraging this quality of openness, and that even if you are very eager to carry around some kind of resentment that somebody's done something that you find unforgivable, or they carry on in a way that you find extremely irritating, and you're not going to drop it, you're not going to let it go, and you really don't think they should be that way, and you've been carrying it around with great vigor and with, a firm grip on your opinion, you're nursing your grudge, and you don't want to let it go, and you've got all kinds of good reasons why you shouldn't let it go. What you find is that as you repeat these words, as you're reciting these words that mean, I ask for your forgiveness for what I have done, or that I I offer my forgiveness to you, and that you are saying those words, or that you invite feedback from others, that that what comes up in your mind is a very clearly highlighted experience of what grudges you're still carrying around, what self-justification you have for the way you like to do things, and if others criticize you or blame you, that's their problem. That as you say those words, as we recite those words and say, please forgive me for anything I've done, it really stands out, the things that that are still being clung to within your heart, your self-justifications within yourself, or your criticisms, your negativity towards others. It really stands out and it's highlighted. So even if you can't quite let it go, at least at that moment the lights are on it, and it's clearly illuminated, and we can notice that. We can be aware of the clinging that's going on. And as I often like to quote one of Lumpur Cha's most helpful teachings, when he said, 50 to 70% of Dhamma practice is knowing that you should let go and not being able to. So you know you're carrying around a grudge. You know that you're carrying around this feelings of self-justification and self-righteousness. Well, I'm right and they're wrong, and I've got I've got all kinds of backup and justification for doing the things the way that I do, and they're stupid. At that moment, we're able to recognize the painfulness of clinging to that. We can see, yeah, the clinging is going on. It's painful to cling. I can't quite let go yet, but at least I can, in this moment, recognize the awkwardness, the painfulness, and the stressful quality of that kind of attachment. Well, the model that we use, the spiritual model that is the central archetype of Buddhist training in the Theravada world, the southern Buddhist world, very clearly and obviously is the archetype of renunciation. It's like taking the eight precepts one day a week, reciting the eight precepts, taking that on as a discipline for the lay community, one day a week, as a training, as a practice. The monastic community, with our renunciant lifestyle, with our shaved heads, our plain robes, the practice of harmlessness, the practice of celibacy, the practice of refraining from eating in the afternoon and evening times of the day. This spirit of renunciation, nekamma, is very much the sort of central form. That's the model, the archetype for spiritual training, how a human being, in a way, the most accessible and comprehensive set of tools that we can use as a human being to train the heart and guide it towards liberation, to guide the heart towards awakening to the true nature of things, awakening to Dhamma. So that this renunciant form is not just putting on robes or reciting the eight precepts or shaving our head, but obviously it's not just changing the behavior, but the point of the renunciant form is to guide the heart, is to guide the inner life that we lead. And so that these ceremonies that we carry out, the invitation and the asking for forgiveness, these kind of ceremonies are very much to do. They're very much a part of the renunciant spirit. They're to do with letting go of opinions, letting go of judgments, letting go of self-justification, or even letting go of self-criticism. you know, maybe we're not sort of proudly blaming everybody else and complaining about others, but maybe what we're carrying around is a terrible collection of regrets about how bad we are and how unmindful and selfish and greedy we are, and how we regret having a negative effect on everyone who's around us, and that we really, 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 really hope that they'll forgive us, but we know they won't because I'm so awful. That maybe that's what we're carrying around. But renunciation is also letting go of negative self-views as well as positive affirmative self-views. That this spirit of renunciation and letting go, dropping the habits of attachment and clinging, this is really a centerpiece of our life and training. And these small ceremonies, they indicate very important aspects of renunciation, very important and central aspects of letting go, so that we are letting go of our, feeling of having to justify ourselves, or the wanting to not forgive others, or carrying around opinions, like and dislike. I like this person, I don't like that person. This one's really good and this one's really annoying, and I like to be with this one, I don't like that one. These ordinary human habits of judgment and like and dislike, preference, that their renunciation is letting go of those same attitudes. So we still experience the tastes of sweet and bitter. We still shiver in the cold, and we feel warm in the direct heat of the sun. Those textures are still there. Those feelings are there. But the issue is not so much a matter of not feeling like or dislike, attraction or repulsion, but the issue is how we can be so easily drawn in to cling to those, to identify with those, to believe those judgments of this is good, this is bad, this person's very wise, this person's really stupid. It's the habit of believing in and clinging to those attitudes in a way that makes them into absolute truths. That's what we're looking at, and that's what these ceremonies and these practices are helping us to do. They're helping us to rouse the attitude of humility, letting go of self-view, of sakkayaditti, and to free the heart of that confinement, because clinging to those attitudes, to our judgments of like and dislike, approval, disapproval, they are constantly strengthening the very things that imprison the heart, the very things that hold us down, the very the bars that form the cage that confine the citta, the heart. The way of life that then we live as samanas, as nuns, as monks, as anagarikas, and lay practitioners, and using this way of life of renunciation, living simply, living in a way that's harmless, that is restrained. This is encouraging or helping to support all those things in our life that are going to help the quality of ease. And that there's this beautiful image, and another of these very compelling images that the Buddha came up with. He said, just like a bird when it takes flight, just like a swan leaving the lake, takes with it everything that it owns. It takes its wings, and it flies. And that, yes, a bird when it goes from one place to another, when it leaves one nest, and then goes, flies away. It takes everything that it owns with it. Its feathers, its body, its wings, and it doesn't carry any luggage. It leaves everything else behind. So too, that this is when we follow this spirit of renunciation, samana sanya, the way of seeing of a samana, one who is a religious seeker. Then in that same way, just like a bird in flight takes with it all that it owns wherever it goes, then it's encouraging us to live in an unburdened way, living in an uncomplicated way. Tomorrow I have the plan to go back and to visit Abhayagiri Monastery once again, where it's a monastery that I founded with the help of many people in California, in Northern California. And I was first invited to go there by Lumpur Sumato back in the late 80s, in the autumn of 89. He asked if I'd like to go along with him on a trip to California, as he was thinking of helping the lay community there to open up a branch monastery so that could serve that group and that area. So I started visiting California from early 90s, from 1990. And then that eventually evolved into the foundation of Abhayagiri Monastery. We were very generously given land, 120 acres of forested land, by Master Xuan Hua, the abbot of a monastery called City of 10,000 Buddhas, in the northern Buddhist tradition, from China. That's very nearby. And then that was opened in June of 1996, and then Ajahn Pasno joined me in January of 97, and the two of us led the place together and helped it to develop over the subsequent 14 years until I got invited to come back here again. I think almost exactly 20 years after Lumpur invited me to go to America, he invited me to come back again. Not exactly to the day, but very, very close. And so then when he made that invitation for me to leave Abhayagiri and to come back to Amravati to take over as abbot here, that was quite a big surprise to me. And I was very, very embedded in the life of the monastery in California. I had literally been there from before day one. I sort of had helped to bring together the group of people there who helped to found it and support it, and had nurtured it along from the get-go. And so for 20 years, from 1990 to 2010. So then there was the prospect of suddenly of leaving it. And then when that was put before me, then it became quite clear how completely I'd assumed I was just going to be there for the rest of my life, and that how I'd taken for granted all sorts of things about what is mine and what things that I need, or what my life is made up of. And so when we made a plan for my departure, so Lumpur made the first invitation in December of 2009, and so then I came back and requested the permission from the Sangha at Abhayagiri to take leave, and they consented. And then I came over here, and then discussed with the community here about whether I was acceptable as taking on the role of abbot here, and that was agreed. So then it was decided I would come just before the rains retreat of 2010. So during that time, there was this a sense of winding up, and this image of the swan leaving the lake, it's like a swan that abandons its lake, it leaves home after home behind, is the saying in the Dhammapada. And the swan takes, the bird takes with it everything that it owns wherever it goes. It really became apparent how much stuff I had. And so as I was drawing my time there to a close, all the stuff in terms of material things, books and papers and other things like that, but also all of the connections, the groups I was a part of, the regular teaching engagements that I was looking after, a whole huge network of connections and relations that I just hadn't really noticed was there, because it was just, that was the very fabric of the world I moved in and operated in. And then suddenly with this gesture of, oh, well, now you're leaving, now you have to say goodbye to this, it was a tremendously helpful and a wonderful lesson in this kind of letting go. And this image kept coming to mind of this sort of the bird in flight with a whole pile of suitcases and packing crates and a whole library with shelves and shelves full of books sort of under its wings while it's trying to flap very unsuccessfully. And so what I decided was that I would leave everything. And I would try to come to England with a single small suitcase as my luggage, so that not like exactly like a bird with just my bowl and my robes, but I compromised with one small suitcase, and I managed to do that. But there was an extraordinary amount of shedding, and just that the whole process of many, many months of saying goodbye to things and dispersing all the books, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books that accumulated around me, going through all the filing cabinets and just getting rid of all of the paperwork. It's just piles and piles of paper, that the stack of paper that was only used on one side, so that the reverse side of it could be recycled and reused, was about 15 inches thick. And the stack of paper that was used on both sides that needed just to be recycled and thrown away, it was about 2 feet thick. And the actual amount of paper that really needed to be kept for important records was about about an inch, if that. This experience of just seeing how much stuff accumulates around a single human life is amazing, and the things that people give you. But it was also very lovely in terms of giving things away. Just being able to give away the different pieces of clothing or camping gear or bits and pieces, Buddha rupas and all of these things that had gathered together. It was a constant shedding and offering and giving. And so that there's, from time to time, there was a very definite wrench in the heart, like, oh, I must take that. I mean, I can't leave that behind. And then that very feeling of a wrench, a kind of tension in the heart, I would use that as an indicator of, oh, there's clinging. If you're a bird in flight, are you going to take this with you? Do you really need to have this particular knick-knack or this particular book? They do have other copies of Harry Potter's book, the Harry Potter books in Britain, actually with an anglicized language rather than the Americanized language, so the English editions are far preferable, incidentally, my humble opinion. So it was a kind of cleansing or sort of flushing experiences, a definite unburdening, and just seeing how a life had accumulated. In a way, it was rather like having a funeral, but not having to go through the kind of uncomfortable business of the body decaying and then and being filled with pain. But it was a living funeral. And then all of the goodbyes, the saying goodbye to all the different groups that I was a part of and had been connected with, and people keeping saying, oh, well, when are you going to come back? Come back soon. You will come back and teach here, won't you? And just to say, I don't know, nothing is fixed, I'm making no guarantees. And again, you'd feel this wrench where people say, oh, please, please, please. And you're just saying the truth, and no, I'm not making any commitments, and no, the future's uncertain, and I'll have my hands full being at Amaravati. So it was a very helpful and wonderful experience of meeting with the whole range and spectrum of attachments and things that had accumulated, all the accumulations of a human life, and then just meeting that in the jitta that wants to hang on to it and own it and be that, and then also say, no, I can let go. And then that those moments of hesitation of like, oh, but yes. And then as soon as something had been given away or dispersed had been let go of, there's this delightful feeling of, ah. And you could feel that, the bird had a bit more wing room and that the didn't have to have so many packages to be carrying along. So the reason why I talk about this now is obviously because I'm going back to visit there to see how things have been developing and progressing, and I know that things have been in extremely good hands with Lumpo Pasano. He's an incredibly competent and skilled leader and teacher, and a very fine human being in so many respects. So I never had any doubt that the place would carry on flourishing without myself there. But it's also just curious to see everybody and to see what changes have been made there. But also, it was in a way the main experience of leaving. I've not been a parent in this lifetime, and so I don't have that immediate experience of watching your children turn 18 and go off to college and leave the nest, and watching the children grow up and be able to sort of do their own thing, but. In many ways, I felt it was probably comparable that my kid was 20. the child is not a child anymore, and I don't need to be around. It doesn't have to have me in the mix to be involved and to be looking after it. And it was also very, very lovely to be able to say to Ajahn Pasano and to everybody there, that I have no stipulations about what I want you to do or not do. It's entirely up to you. I'm not holding any strings here, even though I was the original founder and person who brought things into being in the first place. I don't expect you to keep in touch. I don't expect you to be asking me whether I approve of things that you want to do. It's entirely it's your baby. You're on your own, kid. And that was also had that same sort of bittersweet mix of yes, in your heart of hearts that's the beautiful and appropriate thing to do, and then there's also that the little kind of inner murmur that says, well, I wonder what they're going to do about such and such, or I really hope they don't do X, Y, or Z. And then this, again, seeing that tension or that sort of, ooh, I'm not sure about that. And then feeling that tension, that clinging, and then responding to that by saying, okay, that's another opportunity for renunciation. So that this was a really golden opportunity for me, and one that I hadn't really expected. But it turned out to be a very good learning experience. And so I'm just using this as an example this evening, just for all of us here in our own particular ways, whether we're a lay manager here, or we're an agarika or a sila dara or a bhikkhu, or a lay person here for a few days or a few weeks, or just visiting for an evening. But to see how the natural process of living as a human being brings with it accumulation. It brings with it stuff that we gather to ourselves, we call mine, we call me. This is my thing, my world, my place. And this is me, this is what I am, this belongs to me. Whether it's external, things like your dwelling place or your library or your filing cabinets or your clothes or your jewelry or your possessions, or whether it's the internal, you know, your personal story, your successes, your failures, your loves, your hates, your talents, your shortcomings. Yeah, this in all of these domains, we find this quality of clinging, and it's this the habit of clinging, of attachment, identification, upadana. This is the root of our bondage. This is what ties the heart down. This is the very fabric of the fetters, the shackles that tie this heart to the cycles of birth and death. And that we can use these opportunities for renunciation, taking on the eight precepts for a day, living according to the five precepts in your everyday life, using the monastic form as a nun or as a monk, as an anagarika, as a novice, consciously and repeatedly using these forms as an opportunity to let go, to renounce, to use this the spirit of simplicity and the summoner, the religious seeker, the one who owns nothing, who is ready to always say move at the shortest notice. Yeah, one of the aspects of training that that Ajahn Chah would encourage, and I've always tried to practice this, is he would say, always leave your kuti, your hut, your dwelling place. Yeah. Whenever you leave it, always leave it as if it was you were going to be leaving it for the rest of your life, or you were going to die within the next few minutes. And don't just leave it with bits and pieces lying around in an untidy or scattered way. Don't think, oh, I'll get back to that later, or I'll tidy that up tomorrow. But you should be able to have your kuti, your dwelling place, arranged in such a way that if someone says, "Oh, you got to go, we're moving to a different branch monastery," or the Ajahn's going traveling, you know, and he wants you to go with him, that everything is in its place, and you can move out of that kuti and go, and the place is not left in an untidy and kind of grungy mess. And Lumpur would stress how even if you've been living in the same kuti for 15 years or 20 years, you should still recollect on a daily basis. Yeah, this kuti, this dwelling place, this is just a shelter for one night. And it's immaterial whether we've been there for 20 years and everybody calls it your kuti or your house or your room. And everybody associates that with you and you claim it, you've thoroughly nested. It's still to be considered, oh, this is a roof over the head for one night. This is a one night's shelter, that's all. And that we're taking these ways of highlighting our attitudes and our presumptions, and applying them, using them to see where those habits of attachment, identification, and clinging are, and then in seeing them and knowing them, then to be able to let them go, because there's something in the jitta that says, well, it's not really one night's shelter. I mean, this is my place. It's my kuti. I belong here. This is mine. I chose the place to build it. I wanted it to be here because of this and that. And that just to listen to those internal voices and say, oh, it's the sound of clinging, the sound of attachment right there. And how much more peaceful, delightful, and liberating when that is all dropped. So many of us are going traveling. Myself, I intend to be away for a couple of weeks. Ajahn Sukhacitta already took off for the east coast of America. I hope he is able to make it through the hurricane and land there. He was supposed to have taken off this afternoon, and then Ajahn Bodhipala is going off to Thailand and visit family for a couple of months. Ajahn Ariyasila will soon be moving back to Australia. Many and various of members of the community are separating out. Angela's heading back to Kenya after many years of being here in Britain. So as we part company with each other, really bring it to mind. These ceremonies of asking for forgiveness, of letting things go, these aren't just empty rituals. These are ways of really tying up the loose ends and leaving no unfinished business, like, you know, leaving your kuti in good order as you step out, whether it's for a day or whether it's for many years. These are opportunities to wipe the slate clean, to make sure there's no lingering unfinished business, and to you know, leave things tidily behind us, and to be carrying no extra baggage as we go. No regrets about how we've hurt other people's feelings, or we said something that was cruel, or that carrying resentments around about others, or unfinished business of the many and various kinds, someone is leaving and you think, oh, I really want to thank, you know, Ajahn so and so or Sister so and so because, you know, she really helped me, or he was really been beneficial, and I've never really said that to them, or I've never expressed my gratitude. So it's also a good time to consider, the opportunity is not going to be here for very long, so I should again take the chance to express those things and not leave that unfinished, so that we are carrying that following through that sense of taking care of what needs to be taken care of, addressing those needs of on community life. And then when that's done, when those loose ends are tied up, when the slate is wiped clean, then notice how that feels when you're flying without extra baggage, you know, when you're like using the bird simile rather than the Virgin Atlantic simile. If you're how good it must feel for a bird to just be able to fly freely and not to have extra boxes and bags tied to its feet or sort of clutched in its beak. But how delightful to fly free and to be unburdened, to be unfettered. And if we notice that, we take time to truly recognize that, realize that, then that freedom, that ease, that unburdenedness, it speaks for itself. We don't have to recommend it to ourselves. We don't have to remind ourselves how good it is, because we feel it, we know it directly. It's a direct realization of that quality of freedom. And so it speaks directly to the heart, and the heart knows what that is. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.